Chairman,
okay. Well, I'm starting anyway.
I know.
Recently, we received a response from the Federal Transit Administration approving, with regard to our light rail vehicle procurement, approving a an evaluation criterion that that quantifies domestic job creation, and so we're moving forward with that as a part of the procurement. Just a slight modification to what we already had out, and we don't anticipate any change in the schedule, and that completes my report.
Is that, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This is the employment approach?
Yes.
Yeah, this, and I think, I know when Don was in D.C., he talked about it, the mayor talked about it in D.C., after Don did, and all those, you know, I think this is the first time we've gotten something like that, where we actually have a mechanism to go out and make sure that, you know, some of the folks who are paying all these taxes get some jobs out of the thing. So that's cool.
Yeah. And it is the first in the country, and they wanted to kind of pilot test it with us.
Okay.
That's good. That's the offer we made them. Let us be a pilot. Yeah. No, seriously.
No, yeah. We're willing to do it. I mean, very cool.
All right. Communications.
Good morning. I actually just have one item I want to report on to this committee. With the recent funding situation with the Community College District in Los Angeles County, they have basically discontinued the institutional pass program that we've had for the last several years. They were using construction, I don't know if it's mitigation funds or construction interest funds to pay for the program that we had with over 9 campuses, and it represented, I think, around 60,000 students. So it's a pretty huge impact in terms of for next year. It'll have an impact on the students. We're in the process of notifying the students that the program has been discontinued. We also met yesterday with the Los Angeles Community College to see if we can come with some of the other alternative programs. Currently, the only program that's in place for them today is the $36 reduced pass for full-time students. But I just wanted to bring that item to the attention of this committee because it is a pretty significant impact to one of our pass programs. And that concludes my report.
Any questions on the pass program? Okay. All right, we are going to get a federal and state affairs update. Stimulating, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We've got 5 issues I want to touch on. I'll touch on them briefly, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. First and foremost, after over 2 years of procrastination, it appears that the House and Senate are going to consider authorization bills within the next 30 days. Barbara Boxer will hold a markup most likely in the EPW within that period, and John Micah's people have committed to moving forward as early as mid-June with an authorization bill. This is, as developments go, it's a significant development. We're watching it very carefully. The one provision, the one element that is missing is that neither plan outlines how to pay for their bills, neither the House plan or the Senate plan.
Just a small, minor event.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, not the Senate Finance Committee has been largely silent. The House Ways and Means Committee has said absolutely nothing on the subject. And so, while I think it's great that the policy framework looks like it's just about done in the House and Senate, Senator Boxer and John Micah's people are negotiating the policy aspects, neither financing body has said word one on it.
Well, and the interesting thing to me about that is the fact you can talk about the policy issues all as you want, but it leaves us out of the debate as to how the pots are divvied up and where the money's spent and the kind of programs that they're allocated for. So I don't know how they do one without the other, so this should be unique in American history.
It should be unique, and there was a CBO report that was issued yesterday in a Senate Finance Committee hearing, and it said that the trust fund itself will literally stop being able to have its payments to the highway account by next year, probably mid-next year, and the mass transit account will have the same solvency issues by 2013. So whether or not someone wants to deal with it in Washington, they're going to have to deal with it sooner rather than later. Second issue relates to the federal appropriations process. The House and Senate are going to move on their transportation spending bills for fiscal year 2012. The House transportation bill has gotten what's known as the 302B allocation. That is $47 billion for the coming year. That's opposed to what it was last year, which was $57 billion, and juxtaposed to what the President proposed in his fiscal year 2012 budget of $74 billion. There's a number of concerns we have regarding the House proposal, largely because at our current levels of funding, formula funding, that proposal by the House would severely compromise our agency's ability to secure federal funds. On the new starts front and non-new starts front, a couple of notes. One is that our senators, Senator Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, are working on a letter to Patty Murray urging full appropriation of funds for our two new starts projects. Members of our LA congressional delegation today are circulating a letter in support of the new starts program, and these are two initiatives, both the letters from our senators, the letters from our Los Angeles County congressional delegation that were spurred on by this agency. We interacted with Karen Bass, Henry Waxman, Senator Feinstein, Senator Boxer, and they have been more than happy to help us on the New Starts front. On the non-New Starts front, the Obama administration is going to set the ground rules for Tiger 3. It's a $523 million grant program. The Federal Register notice on that is anticipated within a matter of days, if not weeks. And once that occurs, our staff is going to be looking at what projects that we have that would best compete for Tiger 3 funds. Third, we are concerned about proposals in the House to dramatically slash back transit security funding. Congress has, over the past several years, appropriated anywhere between $3 billion to $2.2 billion to an account that we draw from for our transit security grants. And the House this year, in an appropriation subcommittee markup that occurred last week, gave only $1 billion to that account. So basically slashing the transit security account by a third. And we've got some good concerns with that. Mary Landrieu is the chair of that committee in the Senate. We're working with her. Fourth, the administration earlier this month announced grants for high-speed rail. That was $2 billion that was given back to the USDOT by Florida's governor. $300 million of that money will go for a 20-mile extension of the Central Valley Corridor project, and approximately $68 million will be used to acquire some high-performance rail cars along several of our California corridors, including the Pacific Surfliner. And the fifth comment was related to the Highway Trust Fund, Mr. Chairman. We just talked about that. And last, we're going to have members of our federal advocacy team out here next week, next Wednesday in particular. And I know our staff has reached out to your staff to see when we can have you meet them next week to discuss some of the work we're doing in Washington, D.C. to address our board-approved legislative program. And with that, that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any and all questions. Thank you.
I know the mood on high-speed rail there is almost as tenuous as planning high-speed rail is here. Much talk of reprogramming that money yet, or are they, you know, the president's sort of drawn a line in the sand on this one for reasons that are a little bit beyond me, but what are you hearing about that, Rafi, or any opportunity to use that money in LA in metro territory?
Sure. The House and Senate have really taken two divergent paths. The House has not talked about diverting the money. They have used the word elimination of the money. The Senate remains very strong in their support of high-speed rail. So there's three different narratives. It's a House that seeks elimination of the money, it's a Senate that seeks the preservation of the money, and it's the President, as you outlined, who's committed to continuing the program as it is. So to answer your question, no, there has not been talk of diverting the money.
Thanks, Robert. Any questions?
Hey, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. And today I'd like to update you on the May revision, our bond advocacy efforts, and the recent discussions regarding high-speed rail. On Monday, Governor Brown released his May revision to the January budget proposal. The May revision includes a number of important elements important for Metro. One key recommendation is the continuation of the sales tax on diesel, which provides funding for transit operations in the state of California. And we get about, I think, about $90 million out of that source. Most significantly, the governor includes funding for a fall bond sale. This is important as it clearly signals the governor's understanding of the importance of this sale to California. And Mr. Chairman, at this point, we must thank you again for your advocacy efforts on this because our voice is clearly being heard. We're currently evaluating the specifics of the recommendation and are following up with Caltrans, the California Transportation Commissions, and others to determine exactly what this would mean in terms of funding specific projects. The May revision also makes key three key observations about this particular allocation. First is that the funding is intended to fund existing projects, so that's important for things like the 405 and exposition, we believe. Second is that the funding is also intended to allow new projects to start. And lastly, the administration has commented that many of the agencies that implement bond programs may already have cash from previous sales to fund projects. So we're also following up with the Department of Finance in particular on that piece of it. We're also continuing our advocacy efforts both statewide and with local groups in the public and private sector to support the fall bond sale. We're working with various partners both here and in Sacramento and are receiving very broad support for the fall sale. I'd like to make a few key observations about the May revision at this point. First is that the governor is proposing a modified version of his proposal to extend specific taxes. If these taxes are not extended, then the legislature will have to make additional cuts. The cuts are offset somewhat by the $6.6 billion in new revenue, and there's still some discussion about exactly what kind of revenue that is, if it's one-time or if it's ongoing revenue. The May revision does note that if further cuts are required, additional bond sales could be suspended, so we're not quite out of the woods yet. Second is that the governor highlighted what he calls California's wall of debt. California's budget has been balanced in many ways, and one of these solutions has been borrowing. This has come in the form of short-term and long-term borrowing, and the state has borrowed from both internal sources as well as the now infamous economic recovery bonds. In addition, the state has financed most of its recent infrastructure investment through general obligation bonds. This borrowing now totals $34.7 billion in just budgetary borrowing, $81.1 billion in bonds that have been sold and are now owed, and $48.2 billion in authorized but unsold bonds. It's against this backdrop that we continue our advocacy for the transportation piece of the authorized but unsold bonds. Another issue facing the wall of debt is the high-speed rail project. There continue to be discussions about the high-speed rail project in Sacramento, and this has taken new significance because the federal government has granted significant amounts of money to California's project. This could force the state to issue the high-speed rail bonds. The issuance of the high-speed rail bonds could compete with the bonds for other transportation projects, specifically the bonds from Proposition 1B. Additionally, the legislature is also considering bills relating to the high-speed rail authority that would modify its governance structure and determine who is responsible for actually constructing the project. A recent report by the Legislative Analyst Office highlighted a number of issues with the project. That report recommends that the project be restructured to start in urban areas and that the project be constructed by Caltrans. As you know, the project is currently slated to start in the Central Valley, and there are no commitments at this point for constructing the segments connecting Los Angeles. Restructuring the project to start in the urban areas would require some flexibility from the federal government, and it appears that that flexibility may not be allowed under the current requirements. Mr. Chairman, members, that concludes my report, unless there are any questions.
Thank you.
I would have. I mean, granted, he in the May revise, he put the conditional dollars for bonds in there, and it's nice that he received the message. But it was clear also from my meetings with Treasurer Lockyer that unless there is a budget, there's no bonds, and unless there's a sellable budget to Wall Street, there will be no bonds. And so it's still sort of iffy. While it's at least talked about in a piece of the May revise, without the proper budget that the Treasurer feels comfortable with moving forward to Wall Street, there still won't be any bonds, and so we still have some work to do.
That is absolutely correct.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Just one item I forgot to mention is that, and it's some welcome news, that during your trip to Washington, D.C., and the mayor's trip, and several of the members, I know Director Yaroslavsky, that Barbara Boxer announced that she would be labeling and titling the innovative finance portion of the national authorization bill, America Fast Forward. And I think it may be a small point to some, but I think when a national authorization bill that will govern the nation's transportation policy for the next 6 years is named after something we're doing in this room, it's of some minor note.
Very good. Thank you. All right. Next. Item number four has been polled. Item number five.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, and good morning. I'm David Yale, Deputy Executive Officer for Regional Programming. We are presenting to you a fiscal responsibility project policy for Measure R Transit and Highway Capital Contingency Funds. This policy is an outgrowth of the cost management process and policy. It was requested by the board that we develop this and bring it back to you in April. We brought a draft in April, and revisions were requested. We've made those revisions, and I'd like to walk you through the principal pieces of this policy. Projects with Measure R savings at closeout must first apply such savings to reimbursing contingency funds in the Measure R expenditure plan for any debt service they have benefited from. The base project will be completed at that point, but this will enable us to use the contingency funds for other projects later in the second and third decade. Projects that are accelerated relative to their long-range transportation plan schedule must include that portion of debt service that was necessary to support that faster cash flow. This is consistent with what we've done on the Gold Line Foothill project. Sales tax forecast revisions for the transit and highway subfunds would fall to the contingency. We must maintain the minimum Measure R commitments for every project, so we feel this is only appropriate. And finally, Measure R debt service excluding principal to be repaid from the contingency funds may not exceed the level forecasted in the long-range transportation plan. Our intent here was to ensure that the debt service does not consume all the contingency funds that would be necessary to implement second and third decade projects. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions?
Yes, I have a motion. I think some of this is a little unclear, and I'd like to request the CEO to propose alternative language to Recommendation D at the May 26, 2011 board meeting that would allow for 3010 America Fast Forward and similar financing, which may involve issuing debt and or taking on loans greater than contemplated in the 2009 long-range plan, so long as projects stay within their board-approved funding levels. That's important because if we're able to secure this, we got to make sure the financing, measures with what.
What motion are you talking about?
It's the
It's the piece that was passed out to come my name.
Yeah. What's got your name on it?
That's all right.
Well, you do it.
No. You were. Don, they talked to Julie and staff.
Right. It was the discussion with, and I think David's seen it also, the language on the amendment on D, just designed to keep the option open. It doesn't allow any project to get more money. It just says that if we get additional financing out of DC, we don't have to come back to the board and create a policy. This policy is designed to be flexible in that case only, but it does not increase the cost or the money available to any specific project. They still are bound by Measure R.
But might it not, this new language as I read it, and I've asked the question, jeopardize third decade projects?
The language, as I understand it, it would ask us to come back to you with a recommendation at the full board meeting on this point. Our thinking here was that if we put together a workable 3010 plan and had the necessary legislative and other financing mechanisms in place, we'd come back with you to you with a change in this policy or an exemption from it. I think the motion points out that it would be better if we made that intent explicit now rather than simply come back to you to change the policy later. And I think that's a weakness in our staff report that is a fair point, and we can go back and draft it in a manner that would
that,
permit
but
that.
The devil's in the details, and so you're conceptually doing something that could jeopardize something. That's the issue that I have until I see the language.
Why don't you put in a provision in, the, right. In your amendment that says that lays out that it's not to impact on third decade projects, assuming they're. There is,
yeah.
Not adversely, yeah. Otherwise adversely.
Something like a finding of the board that the 3010 plan brought to them was workable.
Not a finding. The less discretion, the better,
right.
Going into this thing. So I think what the mayor is trying to do here is not be constrained in the event that there are other sources of funding available so we can access it without
right.
being constrained by this policy. And what I think Don is saying, and I agree with him too, is that that's fine as long as there is some source of repayment that holds third decade and second decade projects harmless.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it does. Yeah. It's inconsistent, internally inconsistent, and I don't think that was the intent.
No,
I think exactly right. I would agree with that. Is that a friendly amendment?
I
would accept that rather as the friendly amendment rather.
You're my brother, if not okay. my.
Oh my God!
I'm not sure. That, I don't know where that leaves you in between, but
all I know
inside joke
that could be next week.
Why wait a week?
Yeah, why wait a week?
So, let's just
accept that as a friendly amendment.
Board meeting that allows 3010 and similar financing, which may involve greater than contemplated in 2009. So long as projects stay within their board-approved funding levels, and so long as they do not adversely impact second and third decade projects.
Okay.
That's perfect.
That gives you your marching orders.
And let's make sure between now and the board meeting the language does exactly, let's make sure we got the language right between David so we can all talk. But that's, I agree with the mayor and Zev and the supervisor.
Review it prior to
yes.
An hour before the meeting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. 90 minutes?
20.
Okay. Deal.
Okay.
Okay.
With that, support moving it forward to the next full board meeting. Okay.
Thank you.
Objections? So ordered.
Dr. F. Y. Williams.
Five.
Dr. Clyde Williams, El Sereno, Northeast LA. I get used to it. But the critical elements in this particular recommendation is the word savings. It's mentioned twice. What is the policy for overruns? And as you've indicated, that includes debt service, cost of money, various elements that are not specifically included. So is there going to be a provision in this for how you deal with overruns? The city of Seattle is quite concerned regarding overruns on one of their major highway projects because they are the ones that are going to have to pay the bill. So contingency funds, are they going to pay overruns? Thank you.
Moved by Director Villaraigosa, seconded by Director Katz, without objection, so ordered as amended.
Good morning. I'm Mike Smith, Assistant Treasurer. I'll be presenting items 6, 7, and 8, which due to timing sensitivity are being presented to the Executive Committee as a result of cancellation of the Finance Committee. Item 6 adopts a reimbursement resolution, which would typically be included in the adoption of the annual budget. However, the acquisition of Union Station was not anticipated at this time last year when the budget was developed. The resolution will provide flexibility and timing of the issuance of the commercial paper that will reimburse the Union Station acquisition costs. Are there any questions?
Second, we do have public testimony. Dr. Clyde Williams.
Dr. Clyde Williams, El Sereno. Don't we have a project management information system? Why is there a presumption that you're going to have a cash flow of a significant amount that requires a bond without having it already programmed? It seems like it's a strange thing to have an immediate, let's spend $100 million or let's spend $50 million without it having been planned out. That's why you have a planning and programming committee. It just seems kind of absurd to have more than 60 days. Well, it might say, is this organization that poorly planned that you don't foresee a large cash expenditure within more than 60 days? More than 60 days. Why more than 60 days? Why not just any time? It seems strange. Bye.
Also, it's been moved and seconded. The question I would have is under item number 7. I would really like a report back and prior to the full board meeting on local firm participation to see where we are with that. That's been an issue that's been before us before. It's been elevated from time to time, but I think there's some real opportunity here locally, some local firms. And so as part of coming back to us at the full board meeting with this recommendation, you know where you are with a negotiated bond sale and local firm participation.
On that point, Mr. Chairman, I know the board passed a resolution by the mayor last year, and I believe actually all of us, I think, may have been co-authors on it, that local firms, California firms, particularly since I know this is a negotiated bond sale, so you all get to pick and choose who you're negotiating with. This is not one that, you know, with all due respect to the Goldmans of the world and everybody else, they're making a lot of money. It would be nice to see local firms or California firms get shots at this. And so since it's a negotiated bond sale, we have a policy to do that. We want to encourage California businesses, particularly LA businesses, minority women-owned businesses, you know, all that kind of thing. But we passed the resolution, and it doesn't seem like we see the progress we'd like to see. So I think this is a great opportunity, and I agree with the chair on getting a report back on that. So
it comes back to us for the full board.
Particularly,
we have an opportunity. It's a negotiated sale, so we have an opportunity to abide by our policy.
We talk about number 6 or number 7?
7.
7 and 8, actually. I think it's both 7 and 8 that Don was referring to.
Well, item 8 is unrelated, actually, to item 7.
Can we stick to 7 for a second? I have a question on 7. Are you proposing a negotiated sale of this one refinancing deal?
Yes, that's correct.
How big is the deal?
It is, it would be about $250 million in total.
And could you just explain to me, other than these general statements, why you think that's better for for us than a competitive bid?
Well, as we outline in the report, we see that there's a lack of strong investor demand, so it's helpful to have the underwriters working on our team before the sale. The alternative is, on a competitive transaction, you basically bid the bonds out at the last minute. The underwriter doesn't know in advance of buying them that he's going to own them, so he can't work with the investors in advance. So in less stable market conditions, it's advantageous to have that pre-marketing effort of the underwriter. That's why we would recommend it at this time.
I understand your assertion that there's instability in the market, but there are a lot of local governments who are issuing competitive, going out in a competitive bid environment and are succeeding. Why are you of the opinion that we are advantaged from a cost point of view, the cost of borrowing point of view, by going and negotiated? I mean, the financial industry, the municipal financial industry, on the public side, not on the underwriter side, has always believed that going competitive is advantageous from a cost point of view because you get the best price. People who make money on these deals, the underwriters, have always argued negotiated because they make a lot of money on these deals, much more money than they make on a competitive deal. And I'm, you know, this is a departure from a policy that we've had here for quite a few years. And we used to have this negotiated bid stuff back in the 90s, and we had problems as a result. So I'm just, what evidence do you have that this agency is going to pay less and be more successful and pay less with a negotiated deal than with a competitive deal? I mean, we're issuing competitive debt, going out to competitive bid for the for trans and all kinds of stuff at the county. We're having no problem. $1 billion, not $250 million.
Right. Well, the trans, just as a comparison, are a very short-term obligation, which is easier to sell currently, and there is more investor demand there. The answer to your question is there's no conclusive calculation that anybody can make, but we refer to the debt policy, which lays out the criteria for preference between a competitive sale versus a negotiated sale. And the competitive sale works best in a stable environment where investors are willing to step up and where investors don't have a lot of questions to ask about the credit. The farther you move to the other side of that spectrum with fewer investors, large deal size, credit issues, then it works better to have a negotiated sale.
You're not convincing, and I don't even think you have your heart in the argument you just made. This has always been an issue where the underwriters and their lobbyists come knocking the doors down, whether they're stable in economic environment or unstable economic environment. They always have a scheme and a reason for why they want to do this. So now it's stability. Before it's, we can negotiate a better price if we can negotiate it, which has always been nonsense, because the only way you get the best price is by putting all the sharks up against each other and they bid the price down. I think this is a mistake. Leaving aside the arguments that, you know, obviously we prefer local folks and all that sort of thing, but the bigger issue here is whether we should depart from our relatively long-established policy of competitive bidding on bonds, which is what you're recommending. This is an exemption from our policy, and it's a pretty big deal, huh? Oh, I thought. So I'd like a better understanding of what. I've read your report. Your report is very very superficial, and really doesn't have any evidence to back up what it's saying. And you don't have any evidence to back up what your report is saying. And I just don't. What are other properties around the country doing, around the state? What's BART doing? What are other major properties around the country doing on these refinancing deals?
Unfortunately, I don't know at the moment.
Okay.
Let me make a
Why don't we do this? Why don't we move the item to the full board, obviously?
Without recommendation.
About the issue, without a recommendation.
Well, is there, okay. Is there a deadline on this? Do we have to do this by a certain time?
No, we don't.
Can we put this over to the next meeting, not this one, but the next month's meeting, and have them come back with a report to the committee?
Well, can't they come back on Thursday?
Well, you know what happens at the board meeting. It's a zoo, and I think if there's no jeopardy to waiting a month, I'd rather it come back to the committee. Yeah. Well, come back.
We'll come back here.
It's where it is now. I mean, we're raising the questions we ought to have. If the finance committee wants to look at it, that's fine with me. But
question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Is this a departure from policy, or have we always done sort of a mix and match of negotiated and competitive?
Well, it has been a mix. In fact, with a lot of the refinancings that we've done over the last several years, we've had to use negotiated sales.
Okay, so this isn't a departure from policy. This is just authorization for this particular activity.
Well, that's correct. And the debt policy has a preference for competitive sales.
Based on what's, I think to answer the supervisor's question, we, you know, would be looking at what we've done in the past and how we fared and how that compares to the market and what else is going on would be one way to answer Zev's question, in addition to seeing what Bart or anybody else does along those lines.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. In fact, one of the things I was going to ask, if you could, if we're going to do this next month, bring us a list of the refinancings we've done by competitive and by negotiated, you know, over the last 3 years, if that's a legitimate demarcation.
Well, can we, let me ask this, can we do 6 and 8 and move it forward to the board and hold 7 for 30 days?
I have no problem with 6. I haven't looked at 8.
That,
I have no problem with 8 either.
Okay. All right, so what we'll do then, we'll sort of bifurcate this. We will move items 6 and 8, and item number 7 will be returned to this committee next month. Okay with that?
Yeah. I'm sorry, Don.
Number 8.
I was going to ask on number 8 just a question along the same line. I'm looking at the banks that are listed here in terms of those that were shortlisted. Is this a negotiation or was there a competition to get to this point?
There was a competition. There was an RFP issued to all the major banks.
Okay, and let me go back one also just to refer. The list of folks you were drawing for the competitive for the negotiation on the previous item, was that the bench that was created by the RFP that went out on the Measure R stuff, or is that this separate from that? Have we created a bench with a number of firms?
No, this item is completely separate.
Because okay. That was a competitive process to narrow the list, much like this is in number 8. But that's a different.
Right. Okay. No, we just issued an RFP yesterday for the underwriter selection on number 7 on item 7.
You issued an RFP before you had authorization from the board.
Well.
Yeah, how does that happen?
We did.
Just out of curiosity. Or can we just skip this meeting? No, that's a hell of a question. I mean,
well, thank you. Well, you know,
and the answer to that would be,
I guess we can.
I'm sorry.
We can rescind the RFP if.
But I think Zev's
RFP.
Well, you don't have authority to do that. Well, the question is, you don't have authority to do the RFP. How can an RFP be issued without authority to do so? I mean.
I'd rescind the RFP. If you decide to go that route, you can always reissue it.
Well, I mean, that's the motion before us, basically. You'd have to rescind the RFP because the motion before us then would be to move items 6 and 8 and continue item 7 to report back with the questions that have been asked here and to this EMAC next month. Without objection?
Hey, one last question, Don. On item 8, could you just, in one short paragraph, explain what this is, what we're doing here?
I'm sure. The 2008 bonds are variable rate bonds, VRDBs, that currently have bank liquidity facilities, essentially letters of credit backing them. Those letters of credit expire in September, so we're looking to replace them with a combination of similar facilities, essentially the letters of credit that are called here SBPAs. And also, we're looking to use direct purchase of index bonds by the banks. And as opposed to the bank issuing a letter of credit, the banks have stepped up and said they would actually purchase the bonds for a period of 3 years.
So this is not an issue of competition versus negotiation. This is a totally unrelated thing. Is that correct?
It's completely unrelated to item 7.
But is it a negotiated arrangement here?
It was, no. Well, it started off as with an RFP. We took proposals in, and we're now negotiating with the shortlisted proposers.
The RFP was for, was to do what?
RFP was soliciting liquidity facilities such as the letters of credit or SBPAs, the direct purchase of the bonds, or the public sale of index bonds, all of which would serve the same purpose.
So this language is just stuff that I don't understand.
Sure.
So are we selling bonds here? Is this...
The bonds are already outstanding. They would be reissued in a different mode. They would not be refunded per se, but they would be issued in a new mode for direct purchase, if that's what we choose to do.
And when they're doing it in a new mode, the RFP is for underwriters?
No, it's for banks to provide liquidity facilities.
I got it.
Mike, I believe the proposals were for fees and spreads, right? So there's a quantitative basis.
Yes, that's correct. And then also terms and conditions are very important in this instance.
Competitive proposals based on fees, spread, and conditions.
Yes.
One last
one. I think next time we won't do all three together. It might help, but for all of us. But I am confused about one thing. You said on item 7, this is what we're just questioning, that an RFP went out. Number 7, though, is the negotiated. So why is the negotiated process? Why is there an RFP? I don't understand why there's an RFP if you're negotiating it.
Well, you would select the underwriters still from a set of proposals. So it's a competitive process to identify the lead underwriters. We would then enter into an agreement with the lead underwriters to sell the bonds in a negotiated sales process.
So basically the same process you're using in number 8. I mean, different banks bond, but I mean...
Not really, but...
But number 8, you're doing... you did an RFP, mm-hmm. and then you had a short list, and you're negotiating with the short list.
Right. Well, yeah, we're not just... In both instances, we start with a competitive process.
Okay, that's the piece that... That may be the piece we didn't get the first time. In number 7 is being... The process in number 7 is the same as the process in number 8, even though they're different financial instruments. In number 7, there's an RFP... That will go. That's the RFP he's talking about that nobody approved would be the RFP part of that. Then they'd shortlist from that and then negotiate off the shortlist, just like they're doing in number 8 for a different service. So, what that's worth.
Yeah, but what are you driving at?
No, I'm just saying there is a competitive process at the beginning of number 7. I'm with you on still wanting the data, but there's a competitive process at the beginning of item 7 where they put out an RFP.
Yeah, the competitive process is an RFP to decide who's going to make all this money doing a negotiated sale for our bonds. Is that the same thing as what we're doing in item number 8?
Well, number 8, you had a competitive process, and then you shortlisted all these banks, and now you're negotiating with those banks, right?
Right. There's no, in item 8, there's no subsequent sale.
Right. It's just
right.
Placement.
Or
placement.
Right.
In a generic sense, the reality is a sale versus a replacement.
Right, but I'm going to say process-wise, both have RFPs, both get shortlisted, and both get negotiated, even though they're different items.
Well, I don't think on number 8 they get negotiated, do they?
We're negotiating terms mostly in item 8.
But what do you mean by terms? Like rates?
No, covenants, default terms, remedies.
This is not like a refinancing.
No, it looks mostly like a liquidity facility, a letter of credit.
What's a liquidity facility?
Well, it's a letter of credit where the bank
sounds like an outhouse, but
the banks backing the bonds. If they're very bury bonds, so they're subject to tender on a 7-day notice by the holder. So if the bonds are tendered, the liquidity bank, if the bonds are not remarketed, the liquidity bank would step up and buy the bonds.
And how much? What's the value of all these bonds in number 8 that we're talking about?
$260 million currently.
Okay, get them to both. I'm not getting this number 8 thing at all. Are the banks going to negotiate, when you say the banks going to negotiate terms, with whom?
I'm negotiating with them. They come in with their terms, and then we tell them what we're going to accept.
This is to play, it's the banks with whom we're going to replace these bonds, correct?
For the direct purchase obligations, yes.
We're negotiating. We don't have anybody negotiating on our behalf. You're negotiating with the banks?
Council and I am negotiating. So they proposed a fee spread, which is largely driving the selection process. And then we make sure that we get the terms and conditions that we need.
There's no other way to do this, right? This is the only way to do what you're talking about.
Yes.
There's not a choice between you negotiating with the banks and putting it out to some competition.
No, because this is a very detailed contractual matter.
I'll try this again. We're going to move 6 and 8 to the full board and have item number 7 come back to both finance and EMAC next month.
And maybe even
have our CFO here.
Yes. No disrespect to Mike, none intended, but I'm sort of curious where the CFO is during this.
Okay. Without objection, so ordered. Thank you.
I'm serious about that. No disrespect. Okay, item
number 9 is our proposed audit plan.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to present the results of our annual agency-wide risk assessment and the proposed audit plan for next fiscal year. This is the 6th year that the risk assessment's been conducted, and the results have been summarized for the board. Our methodology is very similar to last year. However, we did update the category onto the CEO's key initiatives that were included in FY12 budget. We continue to place a strong emphasis on the agency's internal control framework and their vulnerability to fraud. And the risk assessment continues to evolve. The focus this year was on the America Fast Forward Initiative and the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, along with the agency's ability to successfully achieve all of its objectives with available staffing. I've included the risk categories in the business plan and wanted to tell you that we've got 14 different categories and included 5 outside agencies. The 2 pervasive risks that are impacting most of our internal risk ranking categories are lean internal staffing, and that's coupled with an inadequate long-term succession plan that's impacting a lot of our risk scoring in the agency. In addition, the other pervasive risk that we see is key information systems developed in the IT risk assessment that was done a while ago, and that's impacting scoring across the agency as well. I put together the proposed audit plan based on the risk assessment to include the highest risk rank categories and the available audit resources that we have. So my audit plan is attached in the board report. This concludes my presentation, and are there any questions for me?
Any questions? If not, could you, while you're here, just address item number 10, and then I'll call on Dr. Clyde Williams.
Okay. 10 is my third quarter report for management audit. We completed 7 projects this quarter and closed 25 audit recommendations. Internal audits are issued during the third quarter, are organized in the report based on magnitude of risk that the findings represent to the agency. I'll talk briefly about 3 of them. One we finished was the customer service centers. We reviewed the process for receipt and handling of funds in fair media, accounting's process of recording transactions, and physical security of the fair media. What we found was about $98,000 of Fair Media could not be reconciled to the funds that were booked for it over the period that we were looking at. And this was basically because some internal controls and internal processes needed to be strengthened. Implementation of the TAP card has reduced some of the associated risk that we found in the audit, and management and communications and accounting are currently working to resolve the issue. The other one I want to talk about is integrated waste management services contract. We've started focusing on large contracts in the agency to determine if they're in compliance with contract terms and there's adequate performance by the contractor. We reviewed the American Reclamation contract and found partial compliance with the terms and conditions, and that the vendor had both overcharged and undercharged the agency on various line items in the contract. We brought this to management's attention while the audit was still going, and they took immediate steps to correct the issues noted in the that we found in the audit. They've installed some new project management processes and general services and met with the contractor on the net overcharges that they had charged us for the time that the contract had been in place. Contractors agreed to pay the agency what he owes us along with interest. The last one I'm going to talk about is the Vanpool contract. At the request of our project manager, we evaluated both Vanpool contractors for compliance with terms and conditions of their contractor. We found one contractor in compliance, and in the other contractor, we were unable to trace expenses directly associated with the program back to their books and records. We did validate that the total expenses they incurred were correct. But they were allocating it to us as opposed to direct charging us. We brought this to the attention of the management here in the agency, and they're working with that contractor on that issue. The other three reports either had no issues or they were insignificant. So this concludes my report. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions?
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Clyde Williams on item number 9 and then item number 10.
I'll put the two together. Dr. Clyde Williams, El Sereno. Interesting. How do we get copies of these reports? That would be an interesting element. So we would be quite concerned with the futures, I think it is, the anticipated compliance to environmental laws, because this should also include the contracting out of such work to Caltrans, because we've experienced a very poor performance of Caltrans for the 710 North Extension scoping sessions, and we'll be taking that otherwise. On item 9, what is item number 24? It's 710 project incurred costs. Highway capital project, perform an incurred cost for cost types. Is this for the entire 710 south and north? It seems to be general. We'd dearly love to have a audit of all of the costs for 710 north that have been incurred. So thank you very much.
Item number 9, we will move by the mayor. I'll chair a second without objection, so ordered. Item number 10, we will receive and file, so ordered. Thank you. Item number 11 has been pulled. Item number 12.
Item number 12 is to convert our current calendar-based monthly and weekly passes into 30 and 7-day rolling passes. The rationale behind this is that it gives our customers greater flexibility in terms of when they purchase passes. Currently, they're limited on monthly passes to a 10-day purchasing window from the 25th through the 10th. This would ease demand through conversion to a rolling day pass. It'll allow a patron to purchase a pass, and the pass would then begin active as soon as they tap for the next 30 or 7 days, depending on which Fair Media Day purchased. We checked with other agencies who have rolling passes to see impacts. Basically, they saw some declines in revenue during the high holiday months, June and December. But other than that, they felt that the trade-off for the customer benefit, as well as increased sales on offering a rolling pass, outweighed the negative impacts. In terms of implementing this program, if approved, we are looking toward introducing it in July, and actually looking at the calendar dates, it would probably be available on, I think it was like August 8th would be the date they would go on sale, which would conclude from the July sales period, and then from that day forward they would be on rolling passes. And staff is recommending approval of this, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Okay, not. Section, I'll move it. Seconded by Villaraigosa. Without objection, so ordered.
Okay, thank you.
Item number 13.
Item number 13 is a $5 day pass demonstration program. And what staff is proposing is to roll back the $6 day pass back to $5 for a period of 9 months. The rationale for the 9 months is after 6 months, staff would come back with a report to identify the impacts of doing a price rollback. Given the gas prices and the market conditions and how we've been modifying service, staff feels that it's an opportune time to test a lower price day pass for rolling it back. If you go historically, the day pass has actually increased at a greater rate than other fare media when we've done our fare increases, and so this brings it in more in line with our fare structure over a during the test period. The rationale for the $5, or actually for the $6, is that equates to 4 one-way trips that are $1.50 each. Rolling it back to $5 is an incentive for people to purchase the $5 pass. And again, the reason for doing it is we would come back to the board in 6 months with results. So we would either work to discontinue it over the next 3 months or extend it if the program was successful. And that concludes my report, and happy to answer any questions.
I do have a question. The $4.5 million potential revenue loss, is that in the budget?
Yes.
It is?
It is now.
It is now.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, like the, I don't know if we realize, item number 12, it makes so much common sense. Everybody was doing it except for us. And anybody that has a kid or a senior or anybody else that gets a pass knows they could buy it 5 days late, 10 days late, and they just get it for the rest of the month instead of getting it, you know, they're paying the full freight. And this program is, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we ought to be doing, taking advantage of the high gas prices, you know, trying to promote ridership at a time when we've cut service. And many of us were concerned about, I think all of us were concerned about it. Some of us weren't for it. But this is the kind of thing we ought to do. And I would just say, particularly since it's in the budget, I would just say as a proposition that we should try that. I mean, we can evaluate this periodically, but I'd like to see us do it. 9 months is, you know, what do you pick that from? I'd like to see us do it for a year. We can evaluate it. If it's not working, then we can always change it. There's nothing that precludes us from doing it. But, you know, this is the kind of policy that makes sense for bus riders. Anybody who's ever ridden a bus just knows that. And particularly, you know, tourism, we're going into the tourism season. People come in here. It's the kind of thing that promotes using buses and trains. You know, all the people, you know, the whole system. Make a friendly amendment. We could always monitor it in between.
You can have a six-month report.
Yeah.
So, just to clarify, so it's to extend it for a year, mm-hmm. is the friendly amendment? And still come back in 6 months?
Yeah.
Okay.
Come back in 6 months.
Well, okay. I mean, I what was the rationale for 9 months?
The demonstration period was 6 months, but if we came back to the board after 6 months, depending on the results of the program, we'd either have to continue it forward. We'd either recommend continuing it forward or discontinue it. So the 9 months gave us a 3 month period to respond.
Friendly amendment to do it a year, and you come back in 6 months to report. Yeah. If it's not working, We don't have to do the full year?
That's exactly right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, but I mean, we also need to know the budgetary implications.
Absolutely. We're talking about number 13 here.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question on this? Is it true that that to buy one of these passes, you need to have a tap card?
Yes.
And you can't buy one of these passes if I go on a bus and I ask the bus driver, can I buy a monthly pass? There's no way I can do that. There's no paper.
Actually, on the rail system, you currently can buy it on using a ticket machine. You can buy a day pass.
I'm talking about on the bus.
On the bus, what we have done is it's an interim solution, which we've been using for over a year now. We've enabled the operators to punch the Metro to Muni transfer and convert that into a day pass. So we came up with a protocol so that they do that. So that is available on bus, but it's not a very workable. It was an interim solution. It was not a permanent solution.
Why can't we have the bus drivers sell bus passes?
We have had that in the past, and that's something we're working on currently, trying to figure out the best path forward for that.
What is there to figure out? If we've done it before, we suspended it. Why? What do we have to figure out?
I think it was an operational thing. That it was slowing up boardings too much, and there were cash problems at one point.
There was a when we started with the tap card program, we were selling tap card day passes on the bus, and there was a problem with control of the media. And there was some audit findings that there was fraud going on in terms of the uncontrolled media. We're working on procedures that will enable us to better control those, and we will be selling bus passes. We will be selling day passes on the bus. So our goal, our intent is to very soon resume selling real day passes on the bus, and we're just working out.
Can you buy a tap card on a bus?
Currently, no.
So, let me just understand. I hear what you're saying, but you're lowering the price on the monthly pass. On the day pass, from $6 to $5, right?
Yes.
But it costs $2 to get a tap card, right?
Yes.
So, I guess it's $7 if I don't have a tap card. And I would decide I want to get a day pass. I got to pay $7.
Yes, for the first time, and then you could always
I think I keep my tap card forever, but if I lose it, every time I lose it, it's another $2.
Exactly, and that's actually been. You can buy a day pass today if you have a tap card on board a bus. So I hope I didn't misrepresent that. If you do have a plastic tap card today, you can buy a $6 day pass.
So they do sell day passes, but only for people who have a tap card?
Exactly, yes.
Maybe you can explain to me what the problem was. I don't want to take the time of the committee, but I think this is it makes sense to be able to buy a day pass on the bus.
I agree, but it's got to be controlled, so.
So you explain it to me, but what's your time frame on trying to figure out a way to do this?
Well, the target date was July, but looking realistically and when we can implement this, will probably be either later July or early August in terms of implementing this. And so we've actually had conversations this morning in terms of trying to figure out the best way to work with our operators and operations to come up with a system where we have both controls and make it, you know, convenient for our customers to find it available. So we're still working on it, and we basically have a July-August.
Maybe you can get a board box item and give us an update.
Yes.
Okay.
So do you hope you can get this done before the pilot program goes into effect? When does this go into effect?
It would go into effect 6 months from when we launch it, so the we would roll back the day passes. Because one of the things that takes time for us is we have to go and modify all the sales equipment, the C passes. Yeah.
I just wanted to. So this is 6 months away from being executed, right?
Yes. Or no, 6 months from the July-August time. We will come back with an exact date of when we
can. Simple question. Is it your objective to have the paper day passes available on the bus by the time this program goes into effect?
We will have, whether it's paper or something, we will have a method for doing that.
It is or something.
Well, there's basically three options. There's paper fare media, which is what we had way back, you know, when we first did the day pass program. There's the plastic tap card, which we can look at making that available on buses for the $2 fee. There's also limited use cards. And the issue with limited use cards is basically the expense, and then there's still control issues because it's a disposable card that does have the chip in it, but there would just be inventory control issues and cost issues that we still have to work out.
I think this tap card thing is goofy. If I come in, my car is a casual or intermittent bus user. If I want to buy a day pass one day, I shouldn't be. And you want to charge me $5 for the day pass? Then charge me $5. Don't make me spend $2, a surcharge, to get a $5 pass. That's BS. I understand you've got operational issues, and I'll stipulate that, although I don't understand, but Don's going to explain it to me later. But let's fix that. The goal should be that if I'm from out, I was just back east, and I wanted to get a day pass. And the easiest way to get a day pass is to be able to get it from the bus driver. And you know, some of us are not computer literate, and we start trying to figure out these. Yeah, I am. Takes me a half an hour to figure out. Anyway, my point is, it should be easy for somebody, especially in Los Angeles, where the buses are the backbone of our system, to be able to walk on the bus and say, "I want a bus pass."
Glasses too.
And the guys who are regular users will get the tap card because it has other advantages. But somebody who's So can I get a commitment from you guys that approach is what is one of the goals you'll have for coming back to before this program or when this program is implemented? You'll give us
Mr.
a board
Chairman
box.
Mr. Chairman, you have the commitment of staff that we will sell the day passes on the bus.
Thank you.
All right. So item 54 has
amended. And with a friendly amendment, with the assurance as it relates to availability on buses, and moved by Director Katz, seconded by Director Yaroslavsky, without objection, so ordered. Thank you. Item 14. Wait, huh?
Yes. Actually, I have a presentation. Item 14 is an update on gating and the TAP program. There was a request at last meeting to update the committee on where we are exactly with gating and our path forward. Just to give a very brief background, the board authorized a study of gating back in July of 2007. We procured it in November of 2007, awarded the contract in January of 2008, and we actually completed the gating system and the fencing in June of 2010. The reasons why the board authorized gating initially was obviously for fare enforcement, as well as improved security, data collection, and then also the availability of having time or distance-based fares off in the future. That shows the thing lighting, if you can see it. One of the advantages we've had so far, and we're just scratching the surface in terms of collecting data from the TAP system and from the gate arrays, we are currently operating in what we call an alert environment, where the lights go on and identify who needs to have their fare inspected. And what this has done for us, actually, is we now know how many people are coming through the stations, so we can tell all the different transactions, which is information we never had before. We know entry and exit data, and we basically know station usage, which is boardings. And these are just some samples of some of the reports that are being collected. And my intent is to, once we delve deeper in this, is to bring back a much more comprehensive report on gating. The most compelling thing about gates and the move toward locking them is, what is the impact of locking the gates? And so what we've done in coordination with the sheriffs is basically simulated gate locking through enforcement. And what this chart up here basically shows you is that we looked at, they did six different periods where they did fare enforcement. And what we did is we compiled that data and we looked at what the baseline was. So the first two charts basically show the activity of gate transactions and sales transactions with no security presence there whatsoever. When we had a passive presence, which was basically the service attendants, these charts show you two things. One, they show you that the gate transactions, in other words, more people were tapping as they went through. And then the other thing is sales transactions, and it shows you more people would go and use the TVMs as through. When we actually had the full sheriffs out there and did 100% fare enforcement, you could see the increase in both tapping as well as TVM transactions. We also recently at the Crest of the CEO videotaped, and I don't have that today, but we videotaped just the patterns of the patrons going through, and you can see the more increased enforcement, how it would impact the behaviors, and more people would go and buy tickets, and also use the, they would get out their tap cards and actually tap. So there is a definite impact, and we estimate between a 40 to 80% increase in taps and sales based on having greater enforcement or actually even locking the gates. But just to put this in perspective, just so you know exactly what we're dealing with, rail ridership currently makes up a little over 20% of our ridership. And our ticket transactions, in other words, the area that gets the greatest impact, equates to about 5% of our total system boardings, or about 8% of our total revenue. So when we see the increases, the gating impact, it's basically the 20 to 40% increase is on that 5%. So in other words, it's the single ticket transactions that go up in sales, because most of our patrons currently have some type of valid fare media, a valid transfer, Metrolink fare media, or something along those lines. So I know in the past when we try to compare sheriff's data with our data, we say, you know, what's the big discrepancy here? And the reality is that even given the increased activity, those numbers aren't in direct conflict with each other. So you can still have a low fare evasion rate, even though you have a much greater increase in transactions at our rail stations, just because of the numbers involved. In terms of the gating models, this was another thing. Currently, we spend about $6 million a year. We use a combination of sheriffs and service attendants to monitor the gates. And what they basically do is they have different kind of service configurations where they do different inspections. They do it after sometimes they do it fully on board. Sometimes they'll shut down the whole, or not shut down, but do it while the train's locked down. They'll do it as people legs at the stations, or they'll do it they're entering the stations, and they have different types of configurations, and we currently have the personnel in place. What was presented to the board when the gating was through was having a remote observation that was basically using security cameras that would identify if patrons had issues or if there were gate issues, and we would disperse the sheriffs or the station attendants as needed. I think we're in the process of purchasing the cameras and have yet to install them. But basically what we're talking about is using the same amount of resources to do a remote monitoring of the system. That being said, there is a belief out there that when you do lock the gates, you are going to need some type of agent out there, or some level of enforcement or human presence that's out there. And so all this chart really shows you is basically from where we are to what a full implementation of having every station have a station agent with three shifts and everything else. And so it's basically a range of costs. And one of the ideals we're moving toward is testing the gates in a locked environment. We're trying to get up to four stations by September, but we think we can do individual stations sooner. But coming up with the optimal fare enforcement model using in a locked gate environment. So when you see the different cost projections and things like that, it's all based on the model we come up with.
Matt, how much have we spent so far? Yeah, on the gating and all this fancy stuff that's not going to be cost effective.
Oh, well, the gating, we currently, it's a $5 million a year lease for the gating, and then the sheriff's is part of the sheriff's contract at $6
million. Okay. It's $5 million for the gating. Does that include maintenance and the equipment? That's soup to nuts, or are there other costs associated with the gating?
I think that's soup to nuts on that.
And the computers and the backroom stuff?
That was a $154 million capital program.
Okay, $154 million there. So it's plus that little other item. So, and how much have we recovered so far? Nada. Right? Wasn't your decision. I'm just looking for some facts just because it still bothers me. We're wasting this money. But anyhow. It's okay. It's all right.
All right, yeah, let's move on. Can we got other committees going here this morning, so you know, we...
I have one question.
Oh, no, right, go right ahead. I'm just going to get rid of Richard's I told you so kind of stuff. Okay.
Yeah. Can I... I've been told that you were going to undertake a pilot program on locking gates.
Yes.
Okay. What's the status of that? When is that going to happen?
Well, when we actually... Our target was September, but to do four stations, but we're hoping we can actually start doing some individual tests as soon as July. So, and basically what that is updating the program so that we can lock down gates at individual stations. So we're in the process of doing that.
How big is the pilot? How many stations are we talking about? Four?
Four, yeah.
So by September, all four will have been done?
Yes. And
start in July.
Yeah. And again, what we'll do is intermittent testing to work the bugs out, yes.
So how many stations will be locked initially in July, do you think?
We would start with like one, or we'd start with gate arrays too. One.
In July, one in August, two in September, is that was?
No, actually what we're envisioning is we would lock the gates down and operate in that environment for a period of time and then put it back the way it was and readjust. So it wouldn't be like once we lock the gates, it's permanent forever.
I understand that, but in terms
about
of
the process,
the
which
four,
month, how many?
How many each month? July 1, August?
We would probably try a different one and so on because there's different configurations for stations. And so
it'd be locked for a month? Is that the length of the pilot?
Sounds
pretty short to me.
Yes. And actually, it might have been shorter than that. Because, again, when you're locking, the biggest issue we have with locking gates is we don't have all of our fair media converted yet. And so when you lock a gate, you automatically exclude Metrolink transfers. You exclude a lot of our own existing fair media that is in the process of being converted, but it won't be converted that time. So when we do lock down a gate, you still have to allow for people to get through that have valid fair media, even though it's not tap-enabled.
How are you going to do that?
That's why it would not be like we would just lock them down and leave them alone. We would have to have some type of presence out there when we do that.
Matt, could I,
sure,
Mr. Chairman, come back next month with a program for exactly what he's talking about in a coherent way? We're not going to just wing it here today with this.
Okay, but Paul, this is something that we've been talking about for a while. And
yes,
I don't understand. I mean, we're getting the impression that we're being told one thing and something else is actually being done or not being done. So if you're going to do a pilot program on locking the gates, to me that means you're going to pilot locking all the gates. If you're going to exempt people, some people with different media, then I don't know how you lock any gates.
So we will come back to you with a
part of the
specific program that we commit to doing, which you will approve.
Paul, could you include in there what we were just talking about? Because I was not aware of that the cubic program they sold us locks all the gates or none of the gates. And in order to do this, we're now having to buy a change order so you can lock a station and not other stations. So, for instance, if we had an incident at a station and wanted to unlock the gates to evacuate it, we have to unlock all the gates at all the stations. So, I just... the dollars.
Yeah.
Please.
We will.
Okay. All right, that's a receiving file. Thank you. Last item is item number 15, AB 845. Historically, we've not done well with an assembly member from Northern California and BART, so could you explain why you want us to support this bill?
Or the CTC.
This is a situation where we actually have a mutual problem with BART. They are our friends on this issue because this bill would codify the guidelines to implement the portion of Proposition 1A, it's a high-speed rail bonds, that flow to local rail agencies for projects that connect to the high-speed rail authority. There's a formula in the bill, and it was actually adopted by the CTC to allocate the funds. We want to codify the formula to allocate the funds, but also codify the guidelines so that we can stabilize the funds from this bond.
The codification, I mean, that doesn't, thinking out just not only short-term but long-term, it doesn't is not going to put us in a position where it blocks some flexibility to access dollars that we may need that BART may not.
No, the formula would actually lock in the shares so that we would know exactly what we get, and then BART would know exactly what they get. And so
that's today.
And it would not change, which we think is to our benefit, because we would then know exactly which funds we get.
But I mean, it doesn't block out something else within the framework of the proposition that would impact us down the road. It doesn't have any impact on anything else and take away our flexibility in our fight with the CTC, and not fight, but our, you know, negotiations with them on various issues, various projects. We always look at short-term.
Yeah.
And this is historical in the sense that this is the kind of thing we run up against sometimes, where it looks good today in short term, but long term, we say, well, you know, AB 845 was in place, so we can't, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think, I understand your point. I think the issue for us would be that if we have the formula in place now, it would not allow, maybe I'm not answering your question correctly, but maybe it would not allow.
I understand the codification of this formula. But the impact of this legislation, you know, you start locking, it's sort of like when the voters go to the polls to protect local revenues. So then they look at the next pot that's not covered and they try to take that. So you got to go back to the polls and go after that. Does this bill, in locking in this formula, going to impact anything that we as an organization and an agency need before the CTC?
I'm not going to give you. I can't give you a definitive answer. I mean, I don't think
that. Answer next week, maybe.
Yeah, I think I do not expect that it would, because this is a specific pot of money. I understand what you're saying, but
maybe we need to put some language in about not being precedential or something. But you know, yeah, I mean, Michael knows better than anyone, because he's the one who has to deal with it up there all the time.
I know.
Don's point is well taken. We have not. I mean, frankly, with Dario Fromer as chair, we'll do better at the CTC than in the past. But he's not going to be chair forever.
Right.
Yes, and we have some good new members like Fran Inman and others.
Because sometimes, a piece of legislation, while it sounds good and appropriate, it's held against you in some other way, shape, or form.
And we've had that happen.
Specific bottom money.
We've had that happen.
Not that I'm not trustworthy. What does the state still owe us from 05, 06, about $350 million? But, you know, other than that, hey, you know, I'm here to serve. All right, so we're going to move this forward without a recommendation, or do you want to support it? Anybody, or just move it forward to the full board and you give us an explanation upon the potential impacts? Because I think I'll probably be there. I just want to make sure the long term is
sure. Sure. Yes.
Short term, it sounds very good.
Yes.
Dr. Clyde Williams. Oh, yay. Thank you. This gives us all the money we need for our 710. No, just joking. Just joking. All right. Okay, so we're moving this full board. Do we have any public comment? Oh, public comment? Okay. All right. All right. So this meeting adjourned. Construction committee will start in 5 or 2 or 3 minutes. All right.